Good morning. Let's try that again. Good morning. That's better. My name is Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober this morning. Another group of miracles. Well, hello there. Another group of miracles. I don't know about you, but I was rarely up at this hour on a Saturday morning during my drinking days. The only part of Saturday morning I saw was about 1 or 2 or 3, and then slept until Saturday afternoon or stayed passed out until then. So every Saturday and Sunday morning when I get up and I'm sober, it's a miracle. This morning, we're going to explore a little bit of a topic of what I call practicing the presence of God. When I first came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm ashamed to admit that when I would come into a meeting and the word God would be said, I'd get up and leave. I didn't want to hear that. I came here to get sober, not get preached at. So if you mentioned God, I didn't want any part of it. I thank God that I had a sponsor who realized what I was doing and made other plans for me, as he often did. Our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I call my owner's manual, has one line in there that has always interested me. It says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Now, normal people would call that kind of a no-brainer. Only alcoholics have to say, well, let me think about it. Can I get back to you tomorrow on that? But that's the way we were. I like very much what Kent said last night about coming into these rooms and getting busy. Because there's a line I heard a lot when I first got sober. I don't hear as much anymore. But we should, and that is the same person will drink again. And if all you do is don't drink and go to meetings, good morning, Polly.
Good morning,
Bill. If all you do is don't drink and go to meetings, that'll work for a while. You can have a little love fest here on the front row. That will work for a while. Fellowship will keep you sober for a while, but it will run out. A little of my background, I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church. Church doors open, we were there. Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, sometimes on Monday and Tuesday. Get up on a Sunday morning. Mama, I don't think I'll go to church this morning. And after I get up off the floor, I go on in and get dressed and go to church. When I went off to college, I got a long way away from it because I had another master that began to intrude in my life called alcohol. When I came to this fellowship, you said that I needed to find a power greater than myself. You even told me I need to do it now. It didn't say first chance you get, find a God of your understanding. It said now. May you find him now. I bristled at that. But I decided I'd just skip it and keep going. I had a Catholic priest. very dear to my wife and me, who said, if you have a trouble with God, just build yourself a wall between you and Him. Build it high, build it wide, and build it deep. And then just proceed on working the steps. And then he'd smile and say, and you will be contacted. And you're going to say, you're not who I thought you were. And that was my experience. When I first came to this program, my sponsor, once he got me focused on the fact that I had better find a God of some understanding, he said, I want you to think about it a couple of weeks, and then we'll talk about it and see what you come up with. Well, I went home and got out some of my old books from my church-going days. I got picked up a couple of books on theology. I got Mr. James' book out and tried to make some sense out of that, and it was a little too deep for me, at least at that point. It took me years to get through that book. And I got a good concept in my mind, because I could always give you a good definition of God. I could give you a three-hour dissertation and never repeat myself, because I had all of this knowledge, you know, the long white robes and the beard and the two little tablets and good, bad, and I knew which one of mine was the longest. I had all that knowledge. But I also got some pointers on theology that I made some notes on. My sponsor said, you ready to talk? I said, yes, sir. I went into his den, and I sat down on the sofa, and he sat in his old recliner chair and looked at me and says, all right, what you got? What is your understanding of God? And I said, well, Doc, to me, God is, he said, you got it. But he said, no, that's it. That's all you need to know. God is. And I can tell you this morning, that's all I know. Because I've come to the belief that a God that I could define or understand is the creator of a universe. I'm supposed to be pretty smart, but I'm not that smart. So in reality, for me, it should say the God of my misunderstanding or lack of understanding. Because you see, to me, it is not important nearly so much that I understand God, that I accept the fact that God understands me. I labored a little bit with, you know, was I going to go to the God of my religion? Or is there another one? Today, I can tell you, I'm still at God is. There are a lot of things in my upbringing, in my Southern Baptist religion, that I adhere to and believe in today. And quite frankly, there are some things that I heard in those Sunday morning services that don't jibe with the God of, that I've come to talk to every morning. I believe in a God of love. A God who wants nothing but the best on this world for me. Not a God who is condemning. In early sobriety, I told my sponsor I was doing a lot of praying and asking for forgiveness for all of those things that had come out in my fourth and fifth steps. And he said, Bill, why are you wasting time praying for forgiveness from a God who never condemned you to begin with? You mean God has forgiven those things I did? He said, almost. In reality, God was forgiving you and loving you even as you did those things. Wow. That's heavy. But I believe that today. I believe in a God who was patiently waiting for me to find my way to Him, or, if you will, back to Him. There's an analogy that C.S. Lewis used many, many years ago. And he wrote it back in the late 1930s or early 1940s. When he was asked about the nature of God and how can there be so many. And he said, well, I'll tell you a little story. There's a man on the throne in England named King George. Now, who is King George? Well, to the Aborigines in the outbacks of Australia, he is a mighty ruler who breathes fire, who can point his finger and send a streak of lightning into you and kill you if you're not doing the right things. That's King George. To the people who lived in the modern part of Australia, who's King George? Well, he is the ruler of the British Empire. He rules from a throne in London, England. He's a mighty ruler, and he demands our obedience. You ask the people of London, who is King George? Well, he's the figurehead of the English British government. And he really doesn't have a tremendous amount of power. Most of that's in Parliament. But King George is a good ruler. I've seen him a number of times riding through the streets of London in his carriage, and I've waved at him, and he's waved back. And then they asked Princess Elizabeth, who is King George? Princess Elizabeth, who just the other day celebrated 90 years. But she was a little girl then, and they said, who is King George to you? King George is my daddy. He holds me when I'm sad. He gives me toys, and he gives me treats. That's King George. Now, here are four very, very different descriptions of King George. But none of them changed him. He was the King of England. We have many understandings of God. We have many names that have been given him by various and sundry religions. But God is. I really don't believe he cares what we call him, but he wants us to call. He wants us to be in touch. Now, I was told early in my sobriety that I had to start each day with prayer and end each day with prayer, which I begrudgingly did on those days when I would remember it. Fortunately, my memory improved, and it's been a few thousand days since I missed doing that. Sometimes, you know, when I forget to do that, days don't go real well. Funny thing about that. But what I would do is I would say the Serenity Prayer, and I would recite the Lord's Prayer to myself, sometimes the third and seventh step prayers. And I might also say, by the way, God, I've got a meeting today. Make sure it comes out good. And then I'd launch off and go into my day. And then I met an old man a little over 33 years ago by the name of Bill Hollingsworth from Roanoke, Virginia. Harold, you remember him. Bill Hollingsworth, at the time when I met him, had 33 years sobriety. He lived to have 40 years of sobriety. Bill said something one time about practicing the presence of God, and he made a talk about it. And some of what you're hearing from me this morning, I've stolen from that talk. But Bill said, you need to practice the presence of God. And I said, I don't really know what that means. Well, to illustrate it, one Sunday morning, when he was making that talk, And you might have been there, Harold. He said, for the next minute, I want us to be silent in this room. This was at a men's workshop and a 4-H club camp between here and Augusta. He said, for the next minute, I want us to have silence, and I want you to feel God's presence in this room this morning. And we did that. And about 40 seconds into that talk, and I promise you, there was no plan to this. There was no notion of this. Nobody had arranged this. But about 40 seconds into that moment of silence, the chimes down at the chapel of the 4-H camp began playing Amazing Grace. We all had our heads bowed, and when that started, we went boom and started looking at each other. And immediately said, how did you arrange that? Bill said, I didn't. He did. I learned from that talk that what I was doing in reality was what I refer to today as hit-and-run prayers. I was getting up, saying those rehearsed, memorized prayers, and for all practical purposes, getting up off my knees and saying, okay, God, I'll see you back here tonight. Have a good day. And then I'd launch off. Stumbling and bumbling and finding my way through life. And Bill said, why don't you, when you get up off your knees, say, come on, God, let's go. And there's a saying I've heard before, said, come on, God, nothing's going to happen to me today that you and I can't handle together. And I practiced doing that, and it took practice. It took practice to remember he's right here. He's right here. He's here. And I can tell you now, I talk to him. I talk to him all day. I talk to him a lot in my car. You know, I'm real grateful for cell phones. Because, you know, when you see somebody, not that many years ago, you see somebody riding along, talking up a storm, and go, now everybody just assumes you're talking on your cell phone. But I'm talking long distance. My prayers changed. I used to say, God, I've got a big board meeting coming up this morning. And I got a proposal I'm presenting. Make sure I get that deal. It seldom worked. So what I would say that I'm retired now, but before I retired, what I learned to say is, God, I'm going in, I'm making a big proposal. Please help me to do my best, and I'll leave the result to you. And that's what I try to do with most of my life today. God is in the results business. I'm not. And I can honestly say in the last 33 plus years that I've been fortunate enough to be a part of this wonderful fellowship. God has never taken a thing in this world away from me that he didn't give me something far better in return. There have been times when I've said, God, you screwed this one up. I should have had that. You messed up this time, but I'm going to let it go. A few days or a few weeks or a few months later, I'd go, oh, now I understand. The something better came along. And it always does. This sign up here says, celebrate the miracle. We hear in these rooms, don't quit before the miracle happens. I got a better line than that. Don't quit before the first miracle happens. Because if you practice the principles of this program, the miracles never stop. They keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. And just when you think it can't possibly get any better, it gets better. This old friend Bill Hollingsworth was fond of saying, when we would read the promises in the meetings, he was fond of saying, "I got a little challenge for you. If you work this program, if you practice those principles in your life, you can't stop the promises. They're coming. Fasten your seatbelts." And whether you've got 33 years or 33 days, 43 days, it doesn't matter. The miracles are there. You and I are on the same journey. I've got a few more miles on the trail. That's all. You know, when I hit 30 years of sobriety, I wanted to go grab the big book, and I wanted to turn to a certain page in there, 85. It says, "What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition." I felt sure that after I had 30 years, mine would say, "What Bill really has now is a semi-annual." Still says daily. And you know, this practicing the presence of God is embodied in that quote. "What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition." That's a two-pronged quote. It is a promise, and it is also a warning. You talk to anyone that you've ever known who relapsed in this program. And I use the term relapse. I don't like slip. That sounds like a little whoops. It's never a whoops. You get drunk in your head a long time before you pick up that drink. But invariably, the people who relapse have lost sight of that daily reprieve and what has to be done to maintain it. Now, one of the things that I put my sponsees through is I introduced them to that line in the big book. And I said, "I want you to spend a few weeks thinking about it. And I want you to write down what your daily maintenance is, what it consists of. Obviously, prayer and meditation. But for me, there's a lot of other things that are part and parcel of that. I talk to between 8 and 10, sometimes 15 drunks on the phone every day, or see them at a meeting every day. I talk to my own sponsor. I've been very fortunate in this fellowship. I have buried 4 sponsors. My first sponsor was a man here in Atlanta named Doc Crandall. My second sponsor was a man named Paul Oliger, who's Polly, and you knew Paul too. In case you don't recognize the name, he is the one who wrote "Acceptance is the Answer to All My Problems Today" in the big book. And following him was a man named Hoyt Allison. And Hoyt was a local sponsor. He loved this program and lived it. And my sponsor that I lost last summer was a man named Dick Martin from Bellevue, Nebraska. And after he died, I ended up going to his sponsor to sponsor me. I'm not sure that was a wise thing to do. His name is Clancy Emmerslin. He sponsors with an iron fist. But I've got to tell you about sponsorship, and I'm going to talk more about it tomorrow morning. I thought I picked every one of my sponsors. Today, I'm not so sure. Because every sponsor I've had, and I'm on my fifth one now, has been exactly what I need at that time in my sobriety. And they are five very, very different men. My first sponsor, Doc Crandall, would grab me by the collar and said, "What part of that do you not understand?" He didn't mind raising his voice at me. I remember one time we were having lunch and I was going out of town the next day, and the next day happened to be my second AA birthday. And I said, "Well, Doc, I'm going to a meeting tonight. I think I'm going to go ahead and pick my chip up tonight, and because I'll be out of town tomorrow." Now, we're sitting in a Po' Folks restaurant. People five tables away heard him say, "The hell you will. You have not earned that chip yet. You don't pick it up till you've got 2 years. Just like a damn drunk. You want half measures." I'm going, N-n-n-n-n-n. I can promise you to this day I have never given or received a chip early. Dr. Paul was a man who never, ever, in the entire 10 years that he was my sponsor, raised his voice. Never heard him raise his voice. Did you, Polly? He just... And he never said things that Doc would say, like, "Are you out of your gourd?" I'd call Dr. Paul up and give him what God and I had worked out, my plan. And I'd get through it and say, "What do you think?" And there'd be a pause, and he'd say, "Well, that's an interesting concept." That was my signal to forget it. Then he would quietly and gently take it apart and show me that I was out of my gourd. Hoyt Allison was in a lot of ways the same way. He believed that everything in this world was in those steps, and he convinced me of it. And then Dick Martin was a great sponsor. The wonderful thing about the sponsors that I've had, and I hope you've been as fortunate, I've never had sponsors who did a lot of telling me what to do. They showed me what to do. They show by their example. They showed me how to practice these principles. I was very fortunate when Dick Martin was my sponsor that if Dick wasn't home, I'd get his wife Peggy on the phone. In reality, I think Peggy sponsored me just about as much as Dick did. And I still call Peggy every once in a while. But God speaks to me through those men, those people. Years ago, for those of you who don't know, I spent 50 years in broadcasting. I did a lot of voiceover work. And one of the projects that I worked on for a number of years was a daily radio feature put out by the Protestant Radio and Television Center here in Atlanta. And the name of the little daily broadcast series, which were like three-minute devotional-type things, the title of it was Be Still and Know. That was the title. I've worked that into my daily maintenance. Because as I read material from books like, 24-hour book, which is not conference approved, but I read it anyway, and the other books that are, after I've done that, I get still and I get quiet. God has never spoken to me through a burning bush. God has never spoken to me through a trumpet. I asked my sponsor one time if a burning sofa counted, and he said it didn't. But you see, God speaks to me through you people. I quite often say I pray for God's will and go to a meeting and find out what it is. Now, I would think, considering my level of education, that God would speak to me through at least a PhD. Sometimes I hear exactly what I need to hear from a 17-year-old kid with 40 days of sobriety. He says exactly what I need to hear. So I got to listen to everybody, because I might miss a message. I also believe, and again we'll talk more about this tomorrow morning, I believe that God speaks to me through that book. I believe he reveals to me what I need to see when I need to see it. I quite often say that every time I read that book, they've rewritten it, because there's stuff in there I'd never seen before. Magic. But again, I think God shows me what I need to see when I need to see it. I give all of the men that I sponsor a little medallion to carry in their pocket along with their whatever chip they have. And the medallion says on one side, we are not cured of alcoholism. And the other side is the quote, what we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. To me, personally, other than the steps to this alcoholic, that's the most important sentence in the big book. Because if I lose sight of that one, I am doomed. Every person, again, that I've ever known that's relapsed, lost sight of that little sentence. And day by day, meeting by meeting, prayer by prayer, phone call by phone call, they diminished and they drank. To die an alcoholic death or to live a spiritual life. I'm very grateful today that that's a no-brainer for me. I don't have to go think about it. I know what I've got in these rooms. Now, I've got such a wagon load of miracles now that there's no way I'm exchanging them for a bottle of vodka. Not worth it. Don't quit before the first miracle happens, and fasten your seatbelts because they never end. In the middle of all these miracles happening, life also happens. And it's not all good. We've been through a lot of deaths close to us in the last 33 years that my wife and I have been sober. Excuse me, she's been sober 34 years. She got sober 4 months before I did. So I'm sorry I forgot that for a second. Polly, she never lets me forget that. Six years ago, life dealt us a blow. We had a doctor tell us that Marlene had a massive malignant tumor in her left lung. And it would never go away. But he said, we have the goal of at least shrinking that tumor and trying to make it dormant. And that's the best we can really hope for. It's small cell lung cancer. It is inoperable. The only way to treat it is with chemotherapy and radiation. And we went through 9 months of living hell, of her going through it and me watching her go through it. and being there with her. And after that 9 months, we sat down in that doctor's office. Oh, I should say, during that 9 months, we signed up at somebody's advice with a little online thing called Caring Bridge. And if you're not familiar with it, that's a website that you can put somebody up there and put their name and what they're fighting or dealing with. A lot of people with cancer. And people will say prayers and leave sweet messages on the website for you. It's very comforting for both Marlene and me. And we thought, you know, maybe 75, 80 of our friends might leave us a message on there. Before that 9 months was over, we had over 5,000 messages from all over the world of people who were praying for her and for us. England, Ireland, Iceland, Germany, Korea, from everywhere. And at the end of the 9 months, we sat down in that oncologist's office. And he pulled out his paperwork and he looked at it. He looked at us. He said, you know, I told you that the best we could hope for would be to shrink that tumor and make it dormant. I said, we remember. He said, I can't explain this, but the tumor is gone. Not shrunk. Gone. And twice or three times a year for the last 6 years, we've gone in for scans. And after 6 years, it's still gone. And when the doctor said, I can't explain that, we looked at each other and said, we can. We can. And that comes from practicing the presence of God and not facing anything in this life without God looking over my shoulder, sometimes whispering in my ear. People have asked, you know, how do you know what God's will is? I said, well, there are many different ways. There are times when I have to find out what God's will is by finding out what it isn't. I do believe that God gets his entertainment from hearing us make our plans. What we really have is a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. It's that simple. If I stay plugged into God, I can't lose. All of the tragedies and everything that have happened in our lives, we have had the greatest, most wonderful toolbox to deal with them, called the 12 Steps. And a God who was watching over us. And I don't think of God as way out there somewhere anymore. He's right here. He's right here in this room. And if I don't lose sight of that, I'm safe. I'm safe from harm's way. I'm safe from my own misdeeds and antics. And one day at a time, I've got a wonderful life that I wouldn't exchange for any high that I ever had. I say that today. I said it yesterday. And I'll say it again tomorrow. Now, I don't pretend to have any answers, but has anybody got any questions or comments or anything that I'd like to add? That's all I have to share. Polly, I can always depend on you.
I just want to tell you, thank you for talking about your God and your miracles.
Thank you. How many of you have never heard Polly Pistol speak? Oh, are you in for a treat? Polly and I go way, 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 way back. There's a good thing about it when we're speaking together. If either one of us gets laryngitis, the other one could tell the story of each other's. But Polly and I have been to the top of Pike's Peak together. We've been to Mount Rushmore together. We even fed little baby black bears together with the baby bottles. So we've been through a lot together, and we've shared some wonderful times, and I'm so glad to see her and Dave here this weekend. My wife always worries a little bit when I'm around Polly that I'm going to run off with her. And I might. No. Dave wouldn't let me. Anybody else? Yes. A little bit louder, Max. No, that's human. Number one, there's nothing wrong with hoping. And there's nothing wrong really with making plans, too. But don't plan the results and try to keep your projector turned off. If this happens, that's going to happen, and that's going to happen, and that's going to happen. There was a gal that we went to meetings with years ago when people would talk about the things like you're talking about life coming along. She would smile and say, "Won't it be interesting to see what God does with this one?" And for me, that's what life's about. You're dealing with a lot right now, Max, but God's there, and so are we. You don't have to deal with any of this by yourself. We'll listen to you gripe. I'll listen to you cuss about it if you want to. But God is in charge. The one thing that I've never been able to do is to get God to synchronize his watch with mine. He just won't do it. It's going to be on his time and his terms. You just keep doing the footwork. You keep applying for jobs. And you keep leaning on us, too. And you got a lot of us. Wherever you go to meetings, you got a lot. When I first got sober, for a number of years, I said, I can't do this by myself. I know I can't do this by myself. I can't do it. And I kept reminding myself of that. And somewhere along the way, and I'm not sure when it happened, I changed it. I don't have to do this by myself. I don't have to do this by myself. You know, the first word in how it, the steps is not I. It's we. And we are a we organization. We're a we fellowship. And, you know, I don't, people ask me, I'm sure you have been asked, if you haven't, you will, how long are you going to have to keep going to those meetings? Or is somebody, I heard somebody say the other day, how long are you going to have to keep going to those classes? The actor Daniel J. Travanti, when Barbara Walters entered, asked him that question, he smiled and said, "I don't know, because I don't know how long I'm going to live. That's how long I'll keep going. Because that's where my friends are, that's where my support is." I've been gone from my water holes now for over 33 years. My bosom buddies, my best friends, my pals, I left them behind in those bars. In 33 years, not one of them has written. Not one of them has called. And you know what? I got a feeling most of them don't even know I'm gone yet. But you let me miss two meetings in a row of my home group, my phone's ringing. Sometimes one meeting. You okay? What's going on with you? I'm fine. You don't sound like it. You know, that's the drunk standard answer. I'm fine. No, you're not. If you're saying that. Yes, ma'am.
What would
you suggest for someone who struggles with blaming God? You know, I'll be honest with you. God, of my understanding, is okay with that. My God's okay with me getting mad at him. As long as I stay connected to him. God has never done things to me. He's done a lot of things for me, and he's done a lot of things with me. But, you know, I don't believe, people say, I think God's testing me. I don't buy that. You know, I don't believe in a God that says, Polly's getting a little too uppity. I need to bring her down a notch or two. I'm going to zap her with a couple of things and see if she can handle it. That doesn't compute with the God of my understanding. I don't think God does things to be blamed for, but if I choose to blame him, I also believe he's okay with it. And as I said, I think he's even okay with me being mad at him once in a while. He just smiles and keeps me wrapped in his love. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but you'd be a lot more comfortable if you could find a way to let go of that blame. And your sponsor can help you do that. Yes, ma'am. Well, I can only tell you my experience. Every time I decide to take charge, God lets me. And then he picks up the pieces when I get through. Again, as I told Max, that's human nature. I mentioned a while ago the Atlanta Men's Workshop. My first sponsor started the workshop back in 1982. And I missed the first one, but I came to the second one in the fall of 82. And have never missed one since then. I just went to my 68th one. 3 years into that experience with that workshop, my sponsor died. And his wife took the checkbook and the card file index and all that and put it in my lap in the night he died. And said, it's in your hands now. And I went, But I took it seriously, so I took charge. I mean, I took charge. I'm going to run this thing right. It took me about 2 years to learn the word delegate. And it took me about 2 more years to figure out who's really in charge. And you know, the funny thing is, since I and the committee that I'm fortunate enough to work with figured that out, things run real smoothly. Right, Mike? Except when people forget to bring the coffee pot back on Saturday for Sunday morning, and that's a different story. Who's next? We've got a couple of minutes. Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to ask you to please speak about forgiveness. Forgiveness for family members and acceptance of, or whatever it takes to understand that sometimes family members do not accept us the way we are.
Well, don't go far, Kent. You're next. You said that family members can't accept you the way you are. That's not your problem. That's their problem. You know, the ninth step doesn't say we made amends and they will, by God, accept those amends. We make our amends. And what they do with it is between them and their God. I'm very fortunate in that 99% of my amends went very well and were very well received. I had a couple that weren't. I had a couple that told me some terrible things to do to myself, which I don't think was possible. And I went running to my sponsor and said, well, I messed that one up. He said, no, you didn't. It's in their hands now. If I ask for forgiveness from another person, I have done my part. And that's all I can do. I can't force someone to accept what I say. I don't know if that helps you or not, but you have to let that go, because you can't control other people. God knows I've tried. The most comforting day of my life was the day that I resigned as chairman of the universe. Life's a lot simpler after I did that. Thomas. Grieving is not easy. It's a process. I hear people say, why did God have to take her, or why did God have to take him? I don't think God takes people. I think he receives people. You don't know what might have been in store for your mother had she stayed here. Whatever it is, your mama is at peace now. And your mom, I believe, is with God now. Would you deprive her of that? Would you want her back to suffer some more? When I lost my mother about 10 or 11 years ago, I grieved and you know, my mother was 90 years old, and she was suffering, and she was ready to go. And I am grateful for the fact that I can stand here this morning and say that when my mother died, we had no unfinished business. The last words we spoke to each other were, "I love you." Do I wish her back? I'd like to have her presence, but I won't bring her back to what she left. I have to thank God for receiving her into his arms. That's my belief, Thomas. We're out of time. I've actually gone over. I think Kent took all he could take and left. But thank you all for listening. And